Hi, nice to be back. And I agree with whoever just typed in. It is beautiful. I just happened to be on the Awakening Together website, and it's quite attractive. And looks, I didn't get a chance to poke around a lot, but it does look like it'd be easier to navigate. So hooray for that! And welcome everyone. Nice to be back with you all. And as always, I'm just going to open the satsang up for your questions. I have a couple questions that I can start with that are just really questions. I think that'll be very brief. These are questions that came in via email in the past week, and so I figured that will both give anyone who does have a question to either type it in if you're here in the room with the chat window, or consider it, ponder it. You can also raise your hand, and then of course I won't be checking email during this hour, but if you do have a question in between satsangs, you can always email it to me at nirmala@endless-satsang.com. And so like I said, give yourself a chance, if you like, to ask a question or suggest something that you would like me to talk about. Yeah, there's my email address. Sure, I'll just type it in for everyone. And so again, like I said, I'll start with these two quick questions because that gives people a little time to kind of get warmed up. So, and me to catch my breath, I was rushing to get here. So, the first question is a very easy one to answer because someone emailed me just before this meeting and asked, can you teach us how to do self-inquiry? And it just so happens that earlier in this series of Wednesday satsangs, I gave a whole three-part talk about the practice of self-inquiry. So there's a lot of material on there that is a direct answer to that question, how to do self-inquiry. Lots of suggestions, lots of different ways of doing the practice, lots of pointers. And so what I'm going to do, I know this will make me drop the mic, but I'm going to paste in a web page on my website, and then I will grab the mic again. Okay, well, it didn't let me paste in because it's a URL. So the easy way to get there on my website, which is endless-satsang.com, is to go to the free teachings tab at the top. And then there's a drop-down, and one of the buttons says free articles. And if you click on that, it will take you to a page. And right near the top of the page, one of the free articles is the practice and purpose of self-inquiry. So you can open up that article because that article is the basis of the three talks that I gave earlier. And I just added to the article a link to the page on the Awakening Together website that has all of the recordings of past satsangs, and I even list the dates. There you go. Regina put it up for me. Thanks, Regina. And again, for those who are just listening, you just go to the website, free teachings, free art, and then the free articles button in the drop-down, and then go to the practice and purpose of self-inquiry. And then from there, you can both read the article and also listen to the three talks. So that, like I said, that was an easy question to answer because I already answered it. So check it out if you missed those talks or if you want to revisit the information. And then another, what's going to be a quick question, even though it's actually it's not that small a question or that simple a question, but it's going to be quick because I don't have a lot to say about it. But someone wrote this week and said that their burning question of the week relates to dementia. Issues with dementia seem to be coming from all directions with family, friends, and colleagues. then she says, and this relates to my saying that the truth is what opens your heart and a small truth contracts your heart. She says, the level of heart contraction I feel related to dementia leads me to believe it is a small truth. And then she even says, although I may be feeling my reaction to the dementia issues. And absolutely, I think that's probably what's going on. It could be your fears or judgments or resistance or just some reactivity that you're having to hearing about somebody having dementia or to the issues that come up with that condition that is causing your heart to contract, because dementia itself, well, you know, I doubt anyone's heart would expand hearing that someone has dementia, but it doesn't have to contract a lot if you keep an open and spacious view of it. And so then she gets more specific, and this may be, again, what's contracting her heart. She says, I think a part of me fears that dementia may prevent the connection to the heart. I know some with dementia become frustrated, angry, even violent, while others may be less anxious than their previous baseline, with almost a childlike contentment. And then she says, this may be unanswerable or even vary with the situation, but is it known if dementia prevents connection to conscious awareness? So that, I said it would be a short question, and that's because I don't have a lot of direct experience either with dementia myself, though sometimes it seems like I'm more forgetful than I used to be, with working with people with that condition. But if just speaking very generally, just taking a big step back, there's nothing that can prevent your connection to consciousness or to your true nature as pure awareness, because that's what you are. It's like you can't. How do you disconnect your finger from your finger? You can disconnect. God forbid this doesn't happen, but you can disconnect your finger from your body, but you can't disconnect your finger from your finger. And so, conscious awareness is what you are. Consciousness is what you are. And so nothing can disconnect you from it or prevent your connection to it, because that's just an impossibility. It can't happen. However, and again, here's where maybe the finger metaphor comes in, something that's an expression of what you are, a lesser aspect of your being, such as your body, your personality, this particular incarnation, you could say, of your true nature, of your soul's being, that, of course, can have all kinds of experiences, including the experience of diminished mental capacity. And that's, for sometimes very difficult to understand reasons, our soul, our being, chooses all kinds of experiences that we might never choose, and other souls, other beings, choose experiences that we can't necessarily understand how they could choose. Everything from extreme poverty, all kinds of illness, mental impairment, birth defects, anything that on the relative level would seem to severely limit our experience of our true nature just by limiting our experience in general. But it just appears that the soul, our essence, gains something from those experiences. There's something actually to be said for limitation, relative limitation, in terms of highlighting certain aspects of our being, highlighting certain capacities or experiences that we can have. And it can, again, on a soul level, having any kind of difficulty can develop compassion, develop humility, develop acceptance. And since this journey can appears to unfold over many lifetimes, it's very hard to judge from the outside how much a soul is gaining from that experience. And there's one other little anecdote that I wanted to share, which was quite a fascinating story. There was this man, English man. Now my name is blanking his name, but Maxwell Cade, that's his name, C-A-D-E. And he created a device that kind of measured a person's brain waves. And specifically it measured all of the different frequencies of brain waves, alpha waves, beta waves, theta waves, and delta waves. And what he discovered as he was using it, he kind of just stumbled upon this observation that a lot of spiritual masters that he hooked up to this machine had a very specific brainwave pattern. It was this he called it the awakened mind. And it just showed up right there on the readout of the machine. And he was, and it was fairly consistent. Whenever he encountered a spiritual master and hooked them up to this machine, there was the pattern. And then, kind of interestingly, my sense of it is that what the machine is showing is that their brain is firing on all four cylinders, you could say, because the pattern that showed up was a peak in all four of those bands of brainwaves. Rather than there kind of being an emphasis, like an overproduction of beta waves and an absence of theta waves, or a lot of theta waves but not many beta waves, these people that he had the pattern he called it the awakened mind had peaks in all four ranges. Again, beta, alpha, theta, and delta are the four main brainwave frequency ranges. And so it seems like it may have something to do with the fourth state in Vedic teaching called Turiya, which they talk about there being sleeping, dreaming, and waking as the three main states that we cycle in and out of, but that there's a fourth state where you are simultaneously experiencing the three other states. So you are both sleeping and waking and dreaming all at the same time. And perhaps that shows up on his brainwave machine. However, relevant to this, related to this question about dementia, that he also started discovering that same brainwave pattern showing up in some people that you one associates or label as a spiritual master. And for example, one group that it seemed to appear in were extremely successful entrepreneurial business people. People who, start big internet companies or, inventors that create a whole new industry. And he would hook them up to the machine, and there would be that pattern. So, again, it seemed like in some, even though their lives were focused in a much more outward direction, that their brains were firing on all cylinders. And then he, in a book, actually by one of his, someone who worked with him and then carried on his work, and again, I'm blanking on her name, but it may come to me. She tells a story of how once they were just curious to see what kinds of patterns they would see on all kinds of brains. They weren't just hooking this machine up to spiritual masters, and there was a child, I believe he had Down syndrome. He had a very severe physical and mental limitation. And they hooked up the machine to this child. And lo and behold, there was the awakened mind brainwave pattern in this person who had very little capacity really to function in a relative sense, in a worldly sense. And yet his brain, his you know, it was, if the brain is reflecting the inner state of consciousness, his inner state of consciousness was actually very awakened. And they asked the mother of the child about this boy, and she shared that he was, in spite of all his limitations, he was a remarkable being, and that people, all kinds of people, would respond to him and just wanted to be with him and sit near him and volunteer to take care of him, and that all kinds of people were drawn to this young boy and just wanted to be in his presence. And so that's a very hopeful view, that these limitations are the expression of our humanness, on the expression of our kind of what would be normal capacities as a human, may not really have ultimately be able to have any effect on our actual underlying state of consciousness, that there can be what you could call an awakened being that is severely disabled and dysfunctional. So like I said, it's a hopeful view. It may explain the wide range of experiences people have with severe dementia, which this woman mentioned in her question. It may explain why some people with dementia become very frustrated, angry, and violent, while others become less anxious and develop an almost childlike contentment in that, you know, in one sense, in the absence of the usual mental chatter. Because if you can't remember anything, there's not so much to think about, not so much to interfere with the underlying state of your consciousness. And so, you know, these different responses may, again, show that even with the limitation of dementia, that the underlying state is not affected. The underlying truth of our being is not affected. So that's the best I can do with an answer, again, in large part because of my own, the fact that I haven't really explored this in depth with any people suffering from dementia personally. So I don't have any direct experience to draw. So I'm going to pause here because, like I said, I just used up all my questions. I have something else I could talk about, but as I always say, I really, really would love for this to be your time for your questions or your concerns or even just, you know, something that you have a burning curiosity about, or even a maybe not so burning curiosity about, but just something you would like me to address. That, you know, it might be that question. I've noticed over the years of giving satsang that often the people who come to satsang have this one question that they ask over and over again. And so with every person they go to satsang with every teacher they encounter, they still have to ask, like, you know, but what about this? And they, you know, they ask the same question. And then some of them would even, you know, this was back when I was traveling for satsang and going, you know, often would go back to the same place, you know, same cities over and over again. And often people would come up and ask the same question that they asked, you know, 3 months ago, 6 months ago, a year ago, and sometimes several times I would go and they would ask that same question. So if you have a question like that, one that you haven't, you know, someone once, a teacher of mine once defined the truth is what, they defined the truth and they said the truth is whatever stops the questions. And so, if you have a question that keeps coming up, that keeps appearing in your life or in your thoughts, And it, you know, it's possible, it's just a chance that I will say something that will stop the question, that will finally satisfy it. Though I have to warn you that often it's just the nature of truth that often even an answer that stops a particular question just brings up even more questions. It's such a, the truth is such a rich and full experience. But on a relative level, when your question is answered, your mind falls relatively silent. The truth is what stops the question. So if you have a question that you would like to throw up on, either by raising your hand or typing it in, that'd be great. And I'm not seeing any. I don't know if someone's typing away madly trying to get their question down. And feel free to, by the way, the trick is start, you know, type the first sentence of your question, hit enter, and then you can type in the rest, just so that I know you're out there wanting with a question. But of course, if you truly don't have a question, that's great too. Sometimes I've found in all the years that I have been in Satsang and attended Satsang with other teachers, that somehow my questions would get answered, even if I didn't raise my hand, even if I didn't get a chance to ask the question. Somehow, whatever was being shared in that meeting was always somehow relevant to what was happening for me. So I will jump in then. In the meantime, I will jump into a little. It's actually a piece of writing by my wife, Gina Lake, who has been on. In fact, I took over this time slot from her, so she's been on here, and there are recordings of her talks. And she's just an amazing, prolific author. And I've been rereading a lot of her books recently. I mentioned that a couple weeks ago. And I wanted to share another piece of her writing and kind of comment on it as I go. So if you happen to get hold of this piece or the book that it comes from, you'll find that I'm not gonna identify when it's her writing and when it's me talking, because I tend to ramble on sometimes and expand on what she said. And so this talk, the title of it is "Your Thoughts and Feelings Are Not Yours," and it comes from her book "From Stress to Stillness." And so, first of all, what a striking topic! What a striking statement! Your thoughts and feelings are not yours. In some respects, on the human level, you know, thoughts and feelings are some of the most intimate experiences we have. It's like our inner experience of our thoughts and our feelings. And yet to jump right in with the title and say that your thoughts and feelings are not yours is a kind of radical concept, to say that they don't actually belong to you, that they are a as the talk is going, you'll see they are a passing phenomenon, something that is really just passing through your awareness. And they may be passing through just like those questions that people ask over and over again in Satsang. Some of our thoughts and feelings are very familiar because they come back a lot. They come up a lot in our experience. And that can even make it seem more like they're ours, like they belong, like somehow they're. In fact, people often believe that not only are these my thoughts and feelings, but they can actually become totally identified and believe that they are their thoughts and feelings. It was Descartes who said, "I think, therefore I am." And, you know, that's taking it to an even deeper form of ownership, to actually identify as your thoughts. And yet, where really did they come from? Have you ever really had an original thought, or are they mostly things you heard or were told? The ones that occur over and over again are things that you were told over and over again. And the feelings that occur over and over again are feelings that were triggered over and over again, most likely when you were younger. And so the thoughts that trigger those feelings were very deeply implanted into your awareness. And so that's kind of a strange thing to think that all of your thoughts and feelings are not yours. They're more like your inheritance, something that you inherit from the world, from your parents, from your teachers, your friends, the media, television, and I would add in there your spiritual teachers and spiritual guides, that you hear things enough and they become your thoughts, or they appear to be your thoughts. They happen so often that you start to think of them as your thoughts or your beliefs. And again, the feelings that those thoughts and beliefs trigger start to feel like they are yours. That's just the way you feel. And it's strange how, I haven't even started reading from Gina's thing yet, and we'll see if I can even get to it. But the strange thing is, even in our language, our language itself kind of induces this kind of over-identification with feelings. And so, you know, instead of saying, I am sad, or I am happy, rather than saying, I feel sad, or I feel happy, or I feel angry, we often just say, I am sad, I am angry. And when you use a construct of language that includes that verb, it's the to-be verb, I am, he is, that is, am, those kind of verbs, they imply a fixed, ongoing condition. They're somewhat more appropriate when we say something like, I am a man, or I am a woman, or I am, 5'4", or I am 6'2", because those are longer lasting qualities or characteristics of our human expression, of our expression as a human. But even those, I would suggest, are not permanent. No one is permanently a man, permanently a woman, permanently 6'2". I still remember I'm about 6 feet tall, and my dad was always 6'3". That was just the truth about my dad. He was a big, tall man, 6'3". And then one day we were standing next to each other. My mom was there, and she said, "Oh my God, you guys are the same height." And sure enough, we stood back to back. This was when my dad was getting older. We stood back to back, and my dad was 6'0". Or he was the same height as me, anyways. Maybe I was shrinking by then, too. But, in one sense, the verb to be, using the verb to be to describe anything, I am this, she is that, he's a jerk, she's a lot of fun, he is a sweetheart, he is a pain in the butt. Any statement like that, there's a falseness built into it, because it implies a static quality. And we do that with our thoughts and beliefs and feelings. We don't just say, I think this, or I feel this. We actually say, I am, someone might say, I am a conservative, or I am a liberal. Which is a whole bundle of beliefs that they have now decided are a permanent fixture, permanent a part of their human expression, and unchangeable, unchanging, unwavering. And I mean, I personally know people who were extremely conservative who, after a while, became, one in particular, became a vegan and an animal rights activist and is very liberal. And, you know, it was kind of striking, actually. It was like, you know, it seemed like maybe he got possessed or something. Because there was such a striking change in his thoughts, in his beliefs. And so when we use those words, I am, and especially for something that fluctuates so dramatically, such as our feelings. Someone said they know of a vegan, conservative, Republican. I guess those aren't truly contradictory. And in this case, all of his beliefs kind of shifted and changed. But when we use that language structure of "I am sad," what a striking statement that is! Because again, it implies that it's a permanent condition, a permanent quality. That's what you are. I equals sad. It's like the two things are being considered equivalent. And so it's just the danger of our language that talk about making it seem like your thoughts or feelings are yours. At that depth, they seem, your thoughts and feelings seem to be you. And yet, how is it possible when your beliefs change or when your feelings change, which they are always doing? Feelings especially, and thoughts too, the specific thoughts that you have, are always, always changing. That's just their nature. They are not, you know, another definition of truth is a more relative way of discriminating how true things are. That suggests that the truer something is, the more truth there is in something, the longer it lasts. And the less true something is, the shorter period of time, the shorter it lasts. And so thoughts, especially specific thoughts and specific feelings, are, you know, sometimes they don't last as long as a fruit fly. They don't last as long as a puff of wind. And yet they happen. They exist, they have some truth in them, but the shortness of their existence is an immediate indicator that they are not very real, they are not very true, or another way of saying it is they are not very important. And in contrast, you know, just relatively, something like your gender, maybe even your career, your relationship status, you know, those last longer than a specific thought or a specific feeling. And so they have more reality, more truth, to say I am a doctor or I am a teacher. And so again, even like the 6'3" truth about my dad, the truth of a career is not a permanent thing. There is a time before and after that experience of being a doctor or a teacher. And actually, it's also true of gender. There's a time before and after. And especially as you get old, you kind of become genderless. But you don't even have to die to stop being a particular gender. It starts being at least a smaller truth, a less important truth. And of course, it can, you know, it's great nowadays, you can even choose to change your gender. So it's not that your gender has no truth or no reality. It just has less. It's less truth than something that doesn't come and go. And of course, in this definition of the truth, the biggest truth, the thing that matters the most, is that which doesn't come and go. And thoughts and feelings are just simply very, very small on that scale. And yet our conditioning is to focus on, to give them attention. Whatever you give attention to appears to be more real. It gives it a sense of having, it actually gives it a sense of having this permanence. That's the crazy thing. If you, whatever you focus on, it starts to seem, I think it's a trick of the mind. It's actually a piece of our conditioning. That our mind tends to assume that the current experience is going to last. It's going to continue. A good example of that is when you have a really, really bad cold or flu. And again, we will often use that same language structure of saying, I am sick, oh, I'm so sick, oh, you won't believe how sick I am. And our mind has a tendency to make that a it pictures that as a permanent situation. When you, especially when you feel really sick, you can actually have this mental concept, this mental thought that, oh God, you know, this is it, my life is over, I'm always going to be sick, I'm so sick, I'm just never going to get better. You know, it's been going on for 3 weeks now, this is it, I'm a goner. And, you know, that it seems like I am sick has become a permanent aspect of our being. And then, you know, the same thing is true when the climate changes, when the, you know, when our physical condition changes, when we, you know, someone said almost like a panic attack. Yeah, when you're that terrified, it can just feel like there's no end to it. That's just, again, it's a trick of the mind, because every panic attack has you know, ended. Every illness eventually ends, either with recovery or if it is your time, you know, you might actually die, in which case you are no longer sick. And so, I was starting to say, and, you know, this is also true of what we might call positive experiences. You know, when you've just fallen in love and, you walk through life and it's just like, I don't know, the rose-colored glasses doesn't even come close to capturing the way the world looks when you've just fallen in love. And you are, you know, I am happy, I am so happy, I'm so, you know, I'm so in love, and you think that's a permanent condition. The mind does that same trick of turning it into not just an experience you're having, but a permanent condition. And so this is one way that our mind tricks us into paying more attention to our thoughts and feelings, and you know, sensations, our physical experience. But, you know, falling in love is a feeling. And we give it so much importance, because along with having been conditioned with the thoughts and the feelings themselves, we've been profoundly conditioned to think they matter. And again, the way you make them matter is you pay attention to them. And of course, when you pay attention to them, then they seem to really matter. So it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy or a self-fulfilling process, that we pay more and more and more attention to our thoughts and feelings, and then they seem more and more important and more real. And in the moment, whatever thought or feeling you're focusing on becomes the sum total of your experience. Now, way back at the beginning of this satsang, someone sent me a question just asking if I could teach how to do self-inquiry. Well, it's funny, I'm coming back around to that, because the alternative, if you take in that, like I said, all I've gotten so far in this article is the title. So if you take in that title, your thoughts and feelings are not yours. You could also say your thoughts and your feelings are not you. They're not you, and they're not yours, then, you know, there's this big question. If something is not very true, not very real, if it's not even very relevant to you, actually, and if it's not who you are, you know, whenever there's a small truth, whenever there's a something that's not very true, not very real, not very important, it leaves, there's a natural question that can arise, which is, okay, then what is true? And if I'm not my thoughts and feelings, even though I've often thought that they were, you know, at least very important, if not actually who I am, if they actually aren't very important, and that's what I've been paying all my attention to, then what is important? And who am I? Who or what is the truth about me? If you start to have enough, even in the process of paying attention to your thoughts and feelings, there can start to be a simple recognition that they're coming home. You know, it comes with a little bit of maturity, you know, when you're, by the way, we could also throw desires, especially our more superficial desires, into this mix, you know, and when you're, I don't know, 12 years old, and there's something that you want, and you want it so bad, you know, you want a go-kart or a new toy that just came out, or a new bicycle, whatever it is, and you just want it so bad, and you think, you know, it just feels like, again, your existence, your whole, you know, like your life is not going to be any good unless you can have that thing. And, you know, it's like sometimes, by the way, when you get it, then you find out that it's not that big a truth. But, you know, as nice as a new bicycle is, it doesn't really change that much. And you quickly acclimate to it. And so right then and there, you know, this is when you're very young, you have these really strong feelings and desires. And you go through that enough times in your life. And again, this recognition that these thoughts and feelings are not very real, not very important, can sometimes just naturally, spontaneously bring up this kind of deeper question, this deeper consideration than what is real. What is it that doesn't come and go? What really matters? And where do the things that really matter come from? What, you can go all the way to the question, who am I? What am I? What is the truth about me if I am not my thoughts and feelings and desires? But there's also a kind of in-between stage, in between arena for inquiry, for exploration. And just for lack of a better word, I would call that essence. You can inquire into your essence. These are the things that actually really matter, and again, on a relative level in the human experience. And yet they are aspects of our true nature, of our spiritual nature. And so these are things like peace and joy and love, happiness, clarity, compassion, true strength and true will, which is really divine will. These are the aspects of our true nature that function in the world, that allow us to function in that kind of human domain of our existence, in the human aspect of our existence. But they are coming from our true nature. And so even if you haven't gotten bit by the self-inquiry bug, where where you spend all your time just trying to sense into the direct sense of I or me, and trying to sense what that is and where it comes from. And of course it becomes a quite paradoxical kind of activity, because it is such a big truth that you can't capture it with your mind. You can't really, you know, if I am not my thoughts and feelings, and if they're not even my thoughts and my feelings, then what am I? What is mine? What is me? And that question is so big. So what it points to is so vast and undefinable that it's a very different experience than when you're narrowly focused on a thought or a feeling or a desire. But what I'm also suggesting is that in between are these, in between the ultimate truth of your being and these kind of inherited narrow considerations of your, you know, how do I feel? What do I want? And what do I think about that? And I'll tell you what I think. And that's, you know, it's almost like we assume that if we think it, it must be important. It must be real. At least most people can, who are still at the mercy of this bigger piece of conditioning that makes them seem so real, seem so important. You'll hear people in a debate or an argument saying, well, that's what I think. And that as if that is proof, as if the fact that I think it means it's unassailable truth. And it's actually a very small truth. So yeah, someone just typed in a question. Okay, can you speak to the distinction between who and what we are? And then they go ahead and say, I understand that being a teacher is not who I am, but doesn't it describe what I am? Where does what we do come into describing who we are? And so, again, the trick here is to understand that there are all these different sizes of truth, different degrees to which something matters or is real or is important, and ultimately the degree to which it's true. And so, I am sad, or I am sick, or I am tired, or I am sleepy. You know, those are, again, if you use that measure of how long does something last, then those are very small truths. They're just things that come and go. They don't, you know, I'm saying they're not yours. They're not really your thoughts and feelings because they're such small truths that they can't. They don't really come from anything deep or essential. They just come from our conditioning and even from our physical impermanent nature. Someone just typed in impermanence. So those are really, really small truths. Now, if what we do, especially if it becomes something like a career, if it becomes, you know, it doesn't even have to be something you do for money, but it's something that you do ongoing, like you sing in the church choir, or you volunteer at the hospital, you like to paint in your free time, and so we'll use that language. I am a painter. I am a volunteer. I am a singer. And you know, it's tricky because we start to have, like the question was, you know, doesn't what I do describe what I am? Well, actually, no, it describes what you do. And that is, you know, if it's something that you do often, I mean, if you go, you go skydiving once on a dare, right? And then when you finally make it to the ground, you say, that's it, I'm never going to do that again. You know, then you're probably not going to describe yourself as, I am a skydiver. You know, because one time when I was young and foolish and drunk, I got talked into it and I jumped out of an airplane. Then you don't take on that as an identity. And so, again, that's a good example because it's something you did once. It doesn't become who you are. You don't make that misunderstanding of starting to describe it as who you are. Whereas if it's even a feeling or a thought that comes along often, and especially an activity or a function that we do, you know, a teacher or even singer or volunteer, those kind of things, we start to get more sloppy with our language. And we, instead of just saying, this is something I do, we start to say, it's something I am. And yet, all careers have a beginning, a middle, and an end. All activities, even ones that you might do for years and decades, there can come a time when you can't do it anymore. Or you lose interest and you stop doing it anymore. And yet, do you stop existing? When you stop volunteering, when you stop painting, when you stop being a teacher, when you stop... it's so inherent in our language, I just used it myself. I said, when you stop being a teacher, you never start being a teacher. But when you stop doing teaching, are you less you? Is there any less a sense of you? And the answer is no. Unless, of course, there's this mental identification. Unless there's this mental confusion. And so, you know, something interferes and you're unable to paint. And you're still holding on to this idea, I am a painter, but, you know, I have this wrist condition and I can't hold the brush anymore. And, you know, so there's this, there can be, actually, it's one of the primary ways we manage to suffer. Is through this confusion. And one way of defining or describing suffering is it's when we take a small truth to be bigger than it is. And so if we hold on to this small idea that I am a painter, or again, more accurately, I paint, I do this thing called painting, but we make it into who I am, we treat it as if it's a big, final, ultimate truth of our true nature, then there can be a tremendous amount of suffering if we're prevented from it, if something interferes. Because in the mind, it can seem like you've lost a piece of who you are. But if you inquire more deeply, then you can discover that you still are who you've always been or what you've always been. So back to this question, who or what we are, you know, whatever question takes you the deepest, whatever question kind of takes you beyond, like someone just typed in, this person with the question said, doesn't what we do point back to who we are, like an adjective modifying the subject? That's a great way to look at it. So again, it's the, you know, if questioning what you do points you back to why do I do it? Who am I? Who am I that I am so drawn to painting? What am I that I feel such a drive to teach or to volunteer? And it's the point of the inquiry question is to point back to who or what we are. And so what we do is an expression of that. And normally we get very involved with these external expressions. Even as I mentioned earlier, you know, the aspects of our being, like joy and love and compassion, that are very fundamental expressions of our true nature. But if we get attached to them, because they are expressions or qualities of our true nature, they just like thoughts and feelings, relatively come and go. So even though they're more real, even though they're more fundamental, the ultimate question, the biggest question is, where do they come from? What is the source of our compassion? What is the source of our peace? Of our joy? What is the source of our awareness? What is the source of our existence? And I don't know if you can sense how that question is pointing in the other direction than the direction in which joy and love and compassion is flowing. It's pointing in the other direction than the direction of most of our activities. Most of what we do is oriented outward. It's oriented out into the world. Quit washing the dishes, taking out the garbage, driving to work, making money. Those are outwardly oriented actions, outwardly oriented expressions of our being. Like I said, including even love and joy and peace. And those, in that sense, they are temporary. There's nothing wrong with them. By the way, all of this, all our thoughts, our feelings, our desires, our beliefs, our actions, our careers, they're all normal and natural and actually healthy. They're all totally valid expressions of our humanness, of our existence here on Earth. And of course, our peace and joy and love are totally valid. So nothing that I'm saying is suggesting that they have no truth or no validity or no importance. It's just there's an opportunity to start to distinguish how much importance do they have. Is love more important than, feeling proud of something you accomplished? Which one matters more? Is a sense of peace and contentment more important than feeling kind of tired or sleepy? Is the source of all of it, is the source of your awareness and consciousness, is that actually ultimately more satisfying, more meaningful, more worthwhile to give your attention to than a mild annoyance with your next door neighbor? And once again, the annoyance is totally natural, totally normal. Annoyance is as normal as rainfall, as normal as sneezing. Every human being on this planet experiences annoyance, experiences confusion, experiences all the whole range of thoughts and feelings and desires. And most people also actually have experiences of their essence of peace and joy and love. And so they're totally normal and natural, but how important are they? How meaningful? And especially if there's a beginning sensing of who and what you really are beyond all that, what it is that doesn't come and go, then that can really put them into perspective. And they can, again, no longer seem like they're yours. No longer seem like they are that important. So you can wake up one morning, this actually happened to me recently, wake up one morning feeling depressed, this big heaviness on your chest, and it's like, so what? Who cares? It's like just, isn't that interesting? I was kind of, I was mildly curious about it. This sensation, I had a strong sense it came from a dream, though I couldn't remember the dream. But I didn't treat it as like, oh no, I'm depressed. Oh God, what, why me? And what can I do to get rid of it? It was just like, that's interesting. There's this big heaviness in my chest. And as almost, as but actually always happens, I got up and by the time I was done taking my shower, it was gone. It just wasn't that important. It wasn't like the story of my life and something that I needed to pay a lot of attention to. I could just go on to paying attention to other things that, including, of course, this beautiful mystery of awareness itself that doesn't come and go, that is always here every morning, afternoon, evening, and middle of the night. So, noticing what's true. through right now, I see that my time is up. So who knows, maybe I'll get to something that Gina wrote at another time. I've got this whole page printed out, and all I managed to actually read was the title. So we'll see what happens next time. And again, please send me your questions or topics that you would like me to discuss. And I see your note, Cheryl. I will take a moment here and think about it and type it in. And we'll I'll let go of the mic so Regina can take over. Bye for now.